The word icon gets thrown around a lot these days. It's almost become a cliché to describe someone as an icon, as the word has lost all meaning. What does being an icon actually mean? Is it because of someone's achievements or someone's influence on other people? Or maybe it's because of individual moments in time which, just down to the sheer enormity of the situation, will be replayed and reheard for the rest of humanity's time on this earth. To me, it's all of these things. I would honestly say that Formula One has only had a handful of truly iconic individuals. Some for their driving skills, some for their achievements, some for their influences on the sport at the time and for future generations, whether that be on the track or off it. But arguably one man has stood above everyone else and will continue to do so for generations to come. Someone who transcended the sport and opened the eyes of the viewer even wider and set the heart racing even more. Someone whose name continues to invoke memories of sheer joy, of sheer drama, and of sheer magic by those who are fortunate enough to witness him at work. Somewhat of a mystical figure to anyone who unfortunately was either not aware of him or not even born during his reign at the top of the motorsporting mountain. I'm Rob Manifield, and welcome to F1 Everything, Episode 1, Ayrton Senna. Ayrton Senna da Silva, born in Sao Paulo, Brazil in 1960, grew up with a privileged background, with wealthy and supportive parents who were able to provide him with the tools to succeed from an early age. Not to say he didn't earn everything he had during the high points of his career, trust me, we'll cover that later. Senna was given a go-kart at the age of 4 and, much like everyone else, worked his way up through the rankings in go-karting in Brazil. In the late 1970s, Ayrton moved to Europe to compete in go-karts, where he raced alongside Terry Fullerton, someone who he would later describe as being his toughest opponent in a time where he enjoyed racing the most, because there was no political bullshit or any money involved. It was pure driving, pure racing. He made quite the name for himself in go-karts, making him quite the hot property when he started racing single-seaters in the early 1980s. In fact, Ron Dennis, the head of McLaren, reached out to Senna to pay for his Formula 3 career, providing he signed for McLaren as his first team in Formula 1. Whilst drivers today would leap at such a chance, Senna realised his stock very early on and declined this unbelievable offer, citing that he wanted to have more freedom in where his career went, thus reducing the pressure on him when he would eventually reach Formula 1, as joining a smaller team would mean he could show off his talents without that immediate requirement to win. Ayrton wanted the traditional route into the sport and earn that top spot in a top team when the chance would arise. Senna would compete in Formula Ford, and then in 1983 he would compete in Formula 3 against British racing driver Martin Brundle, someone who's now more famous for being behind the microphone than behind the wheel. But during that time, he and Ayrton were arguably two of the most talented up-and-coming drivers in the world, both with blinding speed and bravery, and because of their similarities, their on-track battles are the stuff of legend. Many racing historians rank the season-long battle between these two men alongside the likes of Lauda and Hunt in 1976. They would take wins off each other, fighting tooth and nail for the championship, as winning the Formula 3 championship was essentially a stepping stone into motorsport's highest category. It was just as big a battle mentally as it was physically, as both drivers tried to outpsych each other. Famously, they would collide with each other at Snetterton, with Senna attempting the sort of move he'd become infamous for later in his career. Collision resulted with the under tray of Senna's car being lodged onto Brundle's car, preventing the Brit from getting out of the car. Ayrton, even at the age of 23, made it very clear that he was prepared to do anything necessary and put it all on the line to win. Some people love him for it, some people not so much. Senna would arrive in Formula One with Tolman in 1984. The Tolman was neither especially fast nor reliable, but on one particular day that year, Ayrton Senna became a name to be reckoned with during a race where even the greats of that time showed weakness. At Monaco, the toughest race of them all, in weather conditions which would eventually result in a red flag being thrown, Senna sliced his way through the field, capitalising on the mistakes of others to bring him into podium contention. With an incredible manoeuvre into Zandvoort, the first corner, Senna passed world champion Niki Lauda and set his sights on Alain Prost, who was desperately calling for the red flag due to the wet conditions. Ayrton would finish second that day. A few laps longer, there is no doubt he would have caught Prost and probably won. But sometimes you can achieve so much more with a drive to second, like that, than dominate from the front. This was one of those times. Despite Tolman's desperate attempts to retain him for 1985, Ayrton Senna had an opportunity to move up the grid and made the switch to Lotus, a team with a rich racing history and a team who were able to provide Senna a car to match his ever-improving ability. 1985 saw the first of Ayrton Senna's 41 race wins in appalling conditions at Estoril in Portugal. Much like Monaco the previous year, the greats had no response to him that day. For example, Nigel Mansell famously crashed his Williams on the pit straight of all places. Senna, on the other hand, would weather the storm and lap everyone bar one driver, Michele Alboreto in his Ferrari, and seal that first victory. A star had truly been born that day. As far as first race wins go, this might well be the most impressive in Formula One history. It really was a masterclass. The following year, he would win in Jerez after a titanic battle with Nigel Mansell, in which the Brazilian would take the flag 0.014 seconds ahead of Mansell, despite the Williams being the far superior machine. Senna would win a total of 6 races with Lotus, including his first win at Monaco in 1987. In 1988, McLaren came calling, and one of the most famous rivalries in motor racing history began. By 1988, Alain Prost had won 2 world championships and was very much the man to beat in Formula One. Nelson Piquet had managed to do so in 1987, but the 1988 McLaren, the MP44, was unlike any Formula One car that had come before it, and therefore practically eliminated any chance of anyone else getting close. In fact, between Senna and Prost, they won 15 out of 16 races that year. This was the car that would make Ayrton Senna famous, as he performed magic with it, at times even leaving the great Alain Prost scratching his head. After the opening 2 rounds in Brazil and San Marino, Prost and Senna had a win apiece. Prost in Brazil, Senna in Imola. Monaco was round 3, and that weekend we saw everything that Ayrton Senna represented in a nutshell. In qualifying, Senna took pole position, but astonishingly, he did so by lapping 1.5 seconds faster than his 2-time world champion teammate in the same car. Now, 1.5 seconds doesn't sound like a lot, but in Formula One terms, where the margins are so tight, to be that much faster than someone in the same car is truly quite frightening. I would love to know what was running through Prost's head immediately after seeing that lap time pop up on the monitor. In the race, Senna drove like he was from a different planet. Whilst most drivers would leave at least a little bit of space between themselves and the unforgiving Monte Carlo barriers, Senna would dance with them, using every last inch of the track available to him. He since stated that he felt like he was no longer driving conscious, like he was in a different dimension. The circuit was like a tunnel in which he was just going. The thing that led to him crashing the car at Portier with only a handful of laps to go was the team telling him over the radio to slow down as he was leading by nearly a minute from his teammate. In his fury from such a mistake, he vanished back to his apartment and wasn't seen until hours after the race. It's a fascinating set of events because whilst we saw Senna at his best, we also saw that even something small like a radio transmission could drastically alter his mindset. He learned from this mistake. In a way, he had to make that mistake. The championship rolled on and reached Suzuka, the site of Senna and Prost's biggest moments in their rivalry. The McLarens locked out the front row, but Senna got a terrible start and dropped way down the order, having to fight hard to regain the lost ground, and eventually he caught his teammate, overtook him cleanly into the first corner, and went on to win his first world championship. The Brazilian people were utterly delighted. Senna had fulfilled a lifelong dream, and Alain Prost was pissed. Their rivalry would continue into 1989, much the same way it had the previous year, with the McLaren being by far the best car, and come Suzuka, the two teammates were battling for the championship again. Only this time it was Alain Prost to win, and Prost was suitably quicker than Senna in the race. He held the Brazilian at arm's length for most of the race, until lap 46. Heading into the final chicane, Senna from a long way back made his move, and the two drivers collided. Prost was out on the spot, but Senna continued down the escape road, completed a lap with a broken front wing, and pitted for repairs. In the meantime, Prost dashed for the steward's office. Senna quickly caught Alessandro Nannini's Benetton and scored the win. Or so everyone thought. Uncharacteristically, the podium ceremony was delayed, as Senna was called into the steward's office and promptly disqualified from the race result due to using the escape road. This resulted in Prost winning his third title, Senna was left heartbroken, and he greatly considered quitting right there and then, and it took Ron Dennis gently persuading him to continue on that resulted in him returning for 1990. 1990 saw Prost leave for Ferrari, and Senna was partnered by Gerhard Berger, a driver who Senna got along with much better. Senna was in a much better place mentally and, as expected, was fighting for the title as the championship reached Suzuka. Prost once again was probably going to be faster than Senna in the race, but Senna stuck his car on pole position. However, the pole position grid slot was on the dirty side of the track, all but eliminating any advantage from getting the pole in the first place. Senna was informed that the pole position slot would be switched to the opposite side, the side with the racing line, the cleaner side, the side with more grip, but it was then switched back again. Senna was very upset over this, and he would be even more upset when during the driver's briefing earlier in the day, the topic of escape roads was brought up. The president of the FIA at the time, Jean-Marie Balestre, granted the use of the escape road as a way of rejoining the race if a driver made a mistake and missed the chicane. Senna, absolutely seething due to the injustice the previous year about the same topic, stormed out of the room. But this wouldn't be the most memorable thing Senna did that day. Senna had decided beforehand that if Prost jumped him off the line, he was going to go up his inside into the first corner, and whatever happened, happened. And that's exactly what took place. In a reckless, dangerous move, Senna shoved his McLaren inside Alain Prost's Ferrari, and the two drivers went crashing off into the tyres. This highly questionable decision resulted in Ayrton Senna winning his second world championship. Whilst this podcast is not going to be a place where I express my views and opinions often, I feel Senna gets off lightly by people for this particular stunt, yet those same people are always quick to give Michael Schumacher grief over similarly questionable actions. I can imagine the frustration, but if we're being fair here, Senna's second championship was won because of a predetermined act to crash into an opponent, and he shouldn't be let off for it. But for all the bad that came from their rivalry, Senna and Prost's feud catapulted Formula One into a new level of popularity. 1991 was business as usual for Ayrton Senna. It was a much more calm year for him. He finally won his home race in Brazil, despite the car being stuck in gear for the final period of the race, and the strength it required to drive the car to the flag under such circumstances caused him to pass out from the pain. He and Nigel Mansell also had some fantastic battles, including the iconic scrap heading into Turn 1 in Spain, where the two drivers were separated by just millimetres at over 200 miles an hour. Mansell would crash out of the Japanese Grand Prix, gifting Senna his third championship, and everything seemed great. Not only was he dominating the sport, he was becoming such an important name in his native Brazil. He quietly donated millions of dollars to Brazilian charities and began forming the Ayrton Senna Foundation, a charity designed to help underprivileged children. He was seen as a god to the Brazilian people. He was a beacon of hope and positivity. In 1992, Formula One entered a much more technologically driven era. The Williams Renault, driven by Nigel Mansell and Riccardo Patrese, was head and shoulders above everything else on the grid. The FW14B had a fully active suspension, which would stabilise the car through the corners, a semi-automatic gearbox, and traction control, a device which would stop the wheels from spinning up. Senna's car didn't have such luxuries, resulting in Mansell having the title wrapped up by August, and Senna could only secure 3 wins in a somewhat forgettable season by his standards. 1993 wasn't a whole lot better, and with the return of Alain Prost, who had signed for Williams, Senna would miss out on the title again. The European Grand Prix at Donington, however, is the stuff of legend. Senna started 4th and dropped to 5th almost immediately off the line. But by the end of the first lap, he passed everyone in front of him to lead the race. Whilst his rival Prost would have a horrible day and make an unbelievable amount of pit stops on his way to 3rd place, 7 to be exact, Senna would stop just 4 times and lap everyone but Damon Hill's Williams on his way to win. To many, it's the finest drive in F1 history. It's certainly the greatest opening lap in F1 history. In a way, this would be Senna's last truly iconic moment. Prost would go on to win the title and promptly retire from the sport, leaving the door open for Senna to join Williams. Now, you would have thought, considering how good the Williams had been the previous 2 seasons, that things would continue as such in 1994. Far from it. The regulations were changed to make things close again. All the advantages that Williams had enjoyed before were no longer available to them, and the car they provided Senna with was not very good at all. Senna would complain that it was suffering from both understeer and oversteer all at once, a racing driver's nightmare. And worst of all, Benetton had pulled a blinder with their car, and with Michael Schumacher at the wheel, took advantage of a rare Senna mistake in Brazil, and from Senna getting shunted off the road in the first corner at the Pacific Grand Prix to win the opening 2 rounds of the season. Heading into Imola, Senna needed to deliver. The pressure he was under was enormous, and he was absolutely certain that the Benetton was illegally carrying traction control, which would explain why it was so stable and so quick. Now, from this point on in the podcast, things start to get very bleak, so I apologise in advance, but I really want the horror of that weekend to be explained in full. Merely typing the words beforehand and now saying them, it's difficult, and I didn't even watch the race live. In fact, I have never seen the race in full. I don't want to. During Friday practice, young Brazilian driver Rubens Barrichello had a horror shunt coming into the final part of the lap. For those of you who haven't seen it, Rubens gets airborne and flies directly into a tyre barrier right next to the track, causing the nose of the car to crash directly into the ground, which then in turn caused Rubens to smash his head into the steering wheel. The car would come to a rest upside down at the side of the track. Rubens was knocked unconscious, but incredibly survived. Seriously, it's not for the squeamish, but go and find this crash on YouTube. It is shocking. The next day, things were about to take an even worse turn. During qualifying, the young Austrian driver Roland Ratzenberger crashed fatally at over 190 miles an hour through the Villeneuve curve. The sight of his head rolling around in the cockpit as the car came to a stop, it's just horrible. He was pronounced dead not long after the session, And Senna had done what he had done for Martin Donnelly's near fatal crash at Jerez in 1990, and went to see the crash scene. He went to the scene of the crash to see what could be learned from the situation and to help in any way he can. See, that's the thing with Senna. Ruthless maybe, despite his toughness as well, he cared about his fellow drivers immensely. He saved Eric Comas's life at Spa in 1992, where he stopped his car at the crash site and ran across the track to help, putting his own life at risk, and his actions, such as holding Comas's head in place, were vital factors in him surviving. It was in this moment that Professor Sid Watkins, for me, one of the icons of F1 I was talking about at the beginning of the episode, told Senna to walk away from this, and they could just go fishing together. Senna told Sid that he couldn't quit. These two men would meet again the next day, only under unimaginable, horrifying circumstances. On race day, the mood was somber. Formula One had experienced its first fatality at a race weekend in over a decade, and there was still a motor race to complete. Senna had, for the third race in a row, despite the issues he was having with the car, took his 65th and final pole position. Senna's sister has talked about him praying heavily throughout the morning before the race, about what we'll never know. As the race started, there was a heavy start line accident featuring JJ Leto's Benetton and Petrolami in the Lotus. Neither man was seriously hurt, but a tyre flew into the crowd, injuring several spectators. As someone who's been to 14 British Grand Prix, the idea of that happening now just doesn't bear belief. The race wasn't stopped, but instead the safety car came out, and one lap after the restart, Ayrton Senna entered the infamous Tamburello corner and tragically never came out of it. The car suddenly jolted to the right near the exit of the flat-out left-hand corner at some 190 miles an hour and slammed into a concrete wall. A piece of the suspension shaft struck his helmet and Ayrton Senna was pronounced dead a few hours later. The motorsporting world was left utterly shocked. Michael Schumacher won that race, but no one even remotely cares nor remembers that. But lost Ayrton. The finest driver in the world was killed on worldwide television in front of tens of millions of people, and the sport has never been the same since. People talk of being completely numbed by the whole thing. Senna was treated at the trackside by Sid Watkins, who has since said that he knew that the head injury that Ayrton had sustained would be terminal. He then sighed and relaxed, and Sid reckons it was at that moment his spirit departed. I am not going to give an opinion on what I think happened to cause Ayrton Senna's fatal accident. There are a number of things you could point the finger of blame at, but I'm not going to, as it wouldn't be right to do so. Key personnel in the Williams team, including Sir Frank Williams, were actually taken to court, charged with his manslaughter, but were found not guilty. You could say Senna's death opened the eyes of people up to the fact that safety in Formula One needed to be drastically improved, and it was. It was over 20 years until the sport had another fatality, that being Jules Bianchi. Motorsport will always be dangerous, that's the thing it will always be. But Imola 94 remains the darkest weekend in motorsport's history. I don't think it will ever be topped, and nor do I hope it is. Ayrton's funeral is both amazing to behold in a way, just because of the sheer amount of people that lined the streets of Sao Paulo to pay tribute to him. Approximately 3 million, but it is just unbelievably sad. One lady described Senna as being a piece of joy to the Brazilian people, and now that joy was gone. One woman actually committed suicide due to the grief of Senna's death. For me, it wasn't until I watched a Senna movie in 2011 that it hit me as just how tragic Senna's passing really was. I sat and cried in the cinema at the footage of different people throughout his life coming up to his coffin to say goodbye. Sir Frank Williams looks truly mortified. Ron Dennis also looks utterly heartbroken. Everyone did. It's hard to summarise in one paragraph what Ayrton Senna meant for the sport of Formula One. He was a genius. He was ruthless. He sometimes overstepped the mark and did things the wrong way. But there is no denying how good he was. In terms of outright speed and God-given ability, Senna is probably the best racing driver the world will ever know. He wasn't without his flaws, but no one is perfect. He provided the world with some incredible moments in time, moments of genius, drives that are still talked about with bated breath decades later. He provided people with some fantastic quotes to refer to. If you're no longer a go for a gap that exists, you're no longer a racing driver, is probably the most famous of his quotes. His influence on the Brazilian people and his generosity for the poor and all the charity work he did and even his caring of his fellow drivers and his all these things combined show just how much of a special human being he was. And it's all of these things combined together create an icon. And as time goes on, that iconic status will only continue to increase. Ayrton Senna will never ever be forgotten. This episode of F1 Everything was written and created by me, Rob. I do hope you enjoyed this first episode of the podcast. If you did, please spread the word, share the podcast with your friends, and make sure to subscribe and follow me on Twitter at F1 Everything for more content. I'm Rob Manifield, and I'll see you around the next corner.